Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jane Smiley, whose latest books comprise a trilogy, the Last 100 Years trilogy. These books are titled Some Luck, Early Warning, and the most recent is Golden Age. So they've all come out within a year.
Yes, approximately, yeah.
It's called a trilogy, but in many ways it's just a novel divided into three separate.
Absolutely.
And what it is 100 years, year by year, in the life of a family. It starts out as a farming family in Iowa.
So many do.
And later on moves into everything else. And it goes from 1920 to 2019, which is an interesting ending point. Jane Smiley is the author of now 14 novels, short story collections, I guess, or just novels.
Works of adult fiction, I think it would be 16, but two of them were short stories or novellas.
And there are 5 young adult novels and 5 works of nonfiction,
yes,
as well. And Pulitzer Prize winner for 1,000 Acres. Let's get started on this trilogy, these 3 books. You were asked in an interview where the idea came from. You said the idea came from the title, The Last 100 Years.
Mm-hmm.
So where did the title come from?
I have no idea. It just came to me the way ideas do. Lots of times they have to do with place. I was probably whining about some contemporary event back in 2010, and I was probably enraged by something, and I was probably posting something on Facebook or linking to something. And that idea, that title came to me, and I knew it was going to go year by year and that the years were going to be equal or roughly equal, and so that it was going to be quite long, and so it couldn't be one book, so they would have to be split up. I essentially thought it up and got started.
So you had this idea that you were going to just do that, and by doing that you'd be able to, in your own way, comment on all of the events that have taken place.
Or at least portray them, you know. Every novelist has a theory about the meaning of something. Events usually or often take place in a certain way, but you also always have to have a cause and effect theory about them. And so I had to work up a theory, and I had a theory.
The other element you said at one point is that most novels, the stories come and then they end. And, of course, in real life,
yes,
they don't end.
I mean, I'm old. You know, I'm 66 years old. And one of the things that struck me is all those big deal climaxes that I thought were so important, they go away. Sometimes you can barely remember them. Or you say to somebody, do you remember when blah, blah, blah? And then they all say, no, I don't remember that. That's why I wanted to do it year by year, to in some ways simply allow the events to progress rather than making a bigger deal out of some events than others.
You also made the decision to make the chapters pretty much the same length,
yes,
as well. Did you find that at any time constraining?
You know, since I had decided early on to do it that way, then I was willing to go along with it. So I can't say no. I can't say it was difficult. In fact, it was something of an inspiration. So I'd come to my page limit on chapter 32 or whatever, and 1932, let's say.
Right.
And then I'd know that I have to go on to 1933. So that would give me impetus to find out what I didn't know about 1933.
Was there a point where you would just get caught up in a particular, say, element of the story and go on and go, oh, got a cut?
I wouldn't say so, because I was equally interested in all my characters. There's a semi-main character. He's not the protagonist, but he's sort of like the trunk of the tree. He's the eldest son of the original farm couple. Frank, yeah. But I was quite fond of his siblings and his children and some of his cousins and, you know, other relatives, and they would lure me away from him. So I guess, no, I just kept going. There were events that I didn't know enough about, so I would research them and research them and research them, and so, and that was a way of getting caught up in them. But that didn't mean I didn't mind leaving them behind. I did want to leave them behind because I liked my characters and I wanted to jump over to somebody else and see what they were doing. And truly, it was a form of curiosity. It wasn't that I wanted to make them do something. It was that I wanted to see what they were doing. And it was really fun. that part.
You said at one point that you create the characters and kind of just put them in the world and see what's going to happen to them.
Well, that's the way I did in this set of books. And the way I did that was that, you know, I have three kids. And the thing I noticed as soon as the second one was born was that from day one, from the time the nurse put her in my arms, I could feel that she was different from the first one. I could just feel it. And sure enough, she was. And then the third one was quite different from the first two. And they never talk about this in baby books. They don't talk about how unique each child is. And they don't talk about how, in some ways, how decided each child is. At least they didn't used to. I think they do more now. And so I decided that's how I was going to do my characters. I was going to start them out as babies, and I was going to give them characteristics and predilections. And then I was going to send them out into the world. And the world starts as their family. For the Langdons, then it broadens, and so it's the farm itself, which in the 1920s and 30s could be quite a dangerous place for a child. And then they go to school, and then they go to high school, and then they go to college. So their world expands. But they all go into that world in a characteristic way.
Well, I understand that in the second book you hit a problem, which was that, as you put it in an interview, too many blossoms on the vine, and I realized I had to do some pruning.
Yeah, there always has to be pruning. You know, there are some shows that we watch on TV that have a lot of episodes, and I noticed that some of the shows are requiring a lot of pruning, which they're not getting. So it's just a problem with, as characters do more and more stuff, you sort of can't help wanting to follow them, but you have to prune.
And by pruning, does it mean killing them?
No.
Or does it mean, it just means
can't
that they
kill
become,
everybody. You can't kill everybody.
They just go off and they're do their own
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, they go away. A character and setting are always allied to theme in a novel. And so you can't have too many characters expressing the same theme. And so some of those, the little repetitive ones, have to move off to Milwaukee and not come back.
When you mentioned these TV series, now that I think of it, I see a connection between what we're seeing in, dare I say it, the golden age of television we're seeing now in terms of serialized programs and these three books. Is there a connection, I mean, in your mind at all? None.
No, because I don't watch much TV. I mostly watch TV in order to knit. And my husband likes a couple of things, but we mostly watch movies on TV.
When you began, you knew it would be Iowa because that's kind of...
Well, I went back there self-consciously, knowing that people would say that. But I was really, really, really interested in the corporatization of food from the farming level all the way up to the packaging level. And I think that the way we choose to grow and package and sell our food is really indicative of who we are as a culture. And in some ways, that's the base. That's the earthworks that we're built upon. And obviously, Iowa is the place to start. And I could have started, I had to start in Iowa. The other thing is, if you have a farm in Iowa and you have a bunch of kids, some of the kids are going to leave the farm. And one of the kids is going to stay, or two of the kids might stay in the neighborhood. And so I knew that was a good place to send them out from because they would go away. If you have a farm in Salinas, essentially they're going to go to L.A. or San Francisco or San Jose. But if you have a farm in Iowa, they're going to go all over the place.
Well, it helps that you are able to create a fictional town, Denby, nearby, which means that they can play as large or as small a role in the town, and you don't have to try to maneuver them into a real place.
Denby is based on a thought of a real place. It's not that place, though, but I know exactly where they are in Iowa, and I know what the soil is like, and I know what the world
the
that they live in. I'm not telling.
But you know the place very well.
I know
well.
The place, yeah. The reason is that what characters do in the world is very specific to the place that they live. And this book is not set in the same place as 1,000 Acres. 1,000 Acres is set in a certain kind of prairie that was settled in a certain kind of way by a certain group of people. And the effect of their settling, which was to use drainage wells to drain the water off the land, shaped the way that the people live there, especially once pesticides got into the drainage wells. This is not that place. This is a different place. But in its way, it's equally fertile and equally interesting.
I noticed in Golden Age that we hear a lot about Monsanto, we hear a lot about hybrids, we hear a lot about insecticides, but from the perspective of the farmer, in order to survive, they have a very different view than those of us, say, living in places like Berkeley.
Well, Jesse is the farmer who was born in 1956. His dad is Joe, who was born in 1922, and Joe's dad is Walter, who was born in 1895. And Walter has, I guess, what you would say is a traditional American farm. It's got animals. It's got different bunch of crops. It's a lot of hard work. He's very connected to his neighbors because they do harvesting together and that sort of thing. When Walter buys his first tractor, there's a time when he's looking over his shoulder. He's cultivating, and he sees the soil just sort of going up into the sky. And he knows that's bad, but he doesn't know what to do about it. When everybody else around him is beginning to use machinery, he can't imagine still using horses and still doing it in that way. He buys an interesting tool called a lister when he's young, and the lister shifts the soil so that it holds the corn stalks up. So he's well-intentioned. All my characters are well-intentioned. Joe, the son, would really, really, really love to have traditional farm, have animals, grow oats, feed the animals. But Joe is the one who's farming all through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s when farming is changing. And he, too, goes along with the flow because they understand that these are the products, allegedly, that the corporations want. They want corn. They want soybeans. They no longer want oats. They want a lot of them. They want corn-fed beef. They want it to be corporatized. They want it to be cheap. And bit by bit, as we can see, they want to own both the inputs and the product. That's what we can see. Now, for Iowa, it's a wonderful place to grow vegetables. And Joe's wife, Lois, grows a lot of vegetables and is a great cook. But where is she going to sell them? She doesn't live anywhere near someplace like Berkeley where she can get a good price for her lovely lettuce or her terrific heirloom tomatoes. So she grows them for herself. And Jesse goes off. Jesse is Joe's son. He's the adored one. And he goes off to the university, Iowa State, and he decides that he's going to be much more precise than his dad. And he's going to talk about things like inputs. And he's going to measure the soil moisture, and he's going to do everything just exactly right, essentially the way they tell him to do it. I'm sorry, but we've all been there. We've all done everything exactly right, just the way they told us to do it. And it didn't exactly work out, either because they didn't know what they were talking about, or they were trying to cheat us, or they thought the money was more important than how you got the money. That's how corporate America works. Now, I grew up in St. Louis. What's the biggest company in St. Louis? It ain't Budweiser. It's Monsanto.
It is.
Yeah. And there are other seed companies, too. Monsanto isn't the only one. But Jesse has to deal with the enormous pressure that the salesmen put on the farmers. Because if you go back and look at farming just in history, farmers are always dealing with debt. They're always dealing with disaster. They're always dealing with something bad happening before the produce is grown, something bad happening to the harvest. It's a very up and down thing. It's natural for a farmer, especially in the U.S., to assume that if the corporations are running things, maybe they'll smooth out. It's natural to want things to smooth out. I can't say that Jesse gets his way, though. Jesse's wife is also from a farm family. And they have three children, two boys who go into the Army, or one into the Marines and one into the Army, and a daughter, Felicity, who is very smart and becomes quite interested in ecological issues. And she gets involved with a young man from Roxbury, New York, and he is also quite interested in ecological issues. And what they see when they visit the farm isn't good, and that's all I'm going to say.
There's a line about how it took Mesopotamia 1,000 years to destroy their soil.
Thousands, yeah. Probably more than 1,000. Maybe 1,000, who knows. Hundreds, let's put it that way.
Jane Smiley, since we're not actually going to talk too much about it, the end of the book, you do something that the only other person I think who's done it is Doris Lessing in Four Gated City,
mm-hmm.
which is that you project. Now, she smartly did it so far in the future that it didn't matter, but you project year by year, which means you give a result of the 2016 election. And even before that, there have been changes in politics. I won't say what they are. Within a couple of days of this particular interview. But you knew that would happen.
Well, yes, I had to choose because it's called The Last 100 Years and I wanted to start it in 1920.
Why?
Well, I didn't want to talk about the First World War.
Okay.
I wanted to be in the modern era. I didn't want to be before the modern era. So I started in 1920. So I knew I was going to end in 2019. And I went back and forth and back and forth about what would happen in the 4.5 or 4.25 years after the book was published. I've never done any sci-fi, so I decided to do the sci-fi thing, which is to take the dystopian route, which sci-fi usually does. So I decided I was going to have the bad things happen and hope that I was wrong. And that's what I am. I hope that I'm wrong.
Well, so far,
I'm wrong.
Judging by where things have gone since the book was completed, other things look like they're heading differently. Can't necessarily say it'll be better or worse, but just different, which is what happens. I mean, sci-fi is not about predicting the future. It's about talking about the present.
The novel itself as a form is about cause and effect. So I could say, okay, the cause and effects that I saw, the causes I attempted to follow as best I could, the effects are more like little explosions. You don't quite know exactly what's going to happen. As a person, I hope for the best. As a novelist, I had to follow out the effects, because sci-fi is also a little bit of a warning. This could happen if you don't watch out. And that's what you want your readers to think. You want your readers to think, oh, this could happen. We need to avoid this.
Let's get back to some of the earlier events. How did you choose events that would interact or ones that didn't? So People's Temple interacts once you decide you're going to hit the topic of politics in Washington.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to interact. But, for instance, you don't put anybody in New Orleans for Katrina.
I think for my characters, it's more likely that they're going to go east and west. Janet, the character who inadvertently gets involved in the People's Temple, she moves to California, to San Francisco, in the late 60s, early 70s, as a way of getting away from her family. And this, as far as she's concerned, this is the farthest she can go. She moves in with a group of kids. They all go a little bit to the People's Temple, which I thought was quite fascinating.
When you had her moved, when you decided she was going to move, was People's Temple in the back of your mind at all?
No.
Not at all?
No. I just knew what year it was, and then I started looking up, and then I said, oh, huh, that's interesting. So I knew she was moving, and I knew that she was going to live and work as a waitress somewhere in San Francisco. But I didn't foresee that she was going to head to the People's Temple.
So how much foreshadowing in your own brain did you have, say, when you decided to make Michael a hotshot Wall Street guy or Richie a Democratic congressman from Brooklyn?
When I started Volume 3, Golden Age, Richie and Michael are both about 34. And Frank, their dad, has connections both in the financial sector and in the real estate sector. And he sets the boys up with jobs. I can't remember at what point. I always knew Michael was going to go into the financial sector. But I can't quite remember at what point I thought Richie would be fun. It would be fun to do Richie as a congressman. But I probably was fairly early on when I realized what a blithering idiot he is. And I thought, okay, let's stick him in the Congress and see how he does. He's from Brooklyn. He's a Democrat. He can try it out. And he realizes he's out of his depth very early. He goes in the same year that Clinton is elected.
Well, let me stop you for a second. You say he's a blithering...
Oh, I'm teasing him. He's a very sweet boy.
No, you say he's a blithering idiot. When an author says a character is a blithering idiot, it definitely says something about the character. But the question is, how does a character, from your perspective as the writer, mm-hmm. turn into a blithering idiot?
He doesn't get an education. He spends his entire childhood and youth in conflict with his brother, Michael, his twin brother. And every time he could be going to do something and learning something, they get tossed out because they can't stop arguing and fighting with one another. So they eventually end up in military school, and where they're separated, and they make it through military school. And then they go to Cornell University, and finally they're separated after their, I think it's their sophomore year at Cornell.
Well, how conscious for Jane Smiley are these events and what they do, and how much do the characters tell you, and what does it mean to say that the characters tell you what they're going to do?
Well, I don't know exactly how I can express what it means, but it's more like saying, okay, what are they likely to do now? So now that Michael and Richie are out of college and it's apparent that they haven't used college as a way to learn stuff, they have used college as a way to get by or to make connections. Now, you also have to remember that Michael and Richie are both quite good looking, so that works in Richie's favor. When he moves to New York, his girlfriend, or one of the girls he goes out with, is in publishing, and she's quite patient with him because he's a nice guy. Michael is very wild, but they sort of are patient with him because they're related to him. I mean, it's the 1980s. So they just do their stuff, and then opportunities arise. What does this mean to me as an author? They're doing their stuff. I'm looking around. I say, oh, that would be interesting for them to do. So it's not foreordained or planned too far ahead of time. It's planned a little bit ahead of time.
Well, you know that at some point you're going to want to deal, say, you know, in book two, in Early Warning, you're going to want to deal with, say, the AIDS epidemic. How are you going to sort of backtrack to a point where you go, well, you know, I kind of need a gay character in here?
You know, Henry is the gay character. He's
right.
The bookish fourth child. He doesn't know that he's a gay character. He has kind of a fetish for his cousin.
Do you know?
I came to know. I knew before he did, let's put it that way.
Well, I'm saying that...
You don't have to believe me, do you?
I mean, it's going to have to be something. I mean, if you're going to, for example, right, if you're going to involve in book two the politics, the Cold War politics, mm-hmm. and the CIA, let's
yeah.
say. Okay.
A nameless agency. Those words are never spoken in the book.
Okay. If you're going to do that, then it means that at some point...
Yeah.
Without necessarily reverse engineering, or maybe it is, you're going to have to put someone there somehow. So there.
Yeah. The way we get into the CIA in book one is that Lillian, the darling, Lillian is working at a soda fountain in town, and a young man who's very charming and has an interesting past is going through town, and he is quite taken with her. She's been much adored by her family, but she hasn't been a big social success at school, and he just is irresistible, and so she can't resist him, and he takes her away. He's the one who turns out to work for a strangely familiar government agency.
And that's how you bring it in.
And that's how I bring it in. He's a very charming, well-meaning, terrific storyteller, great joker, wonderful family man. The only thing he wants in life is a wife and a bunch of children, and he goes out and plays with them. But he has a job, and it's an administrative job in a certain agency.
And so at that point, you kind of know he's there. Meanwhile, you've developed the character of Frank.
Yes.
So you know Frank is a certain kind of character.
Yes.
And therefore, putting the two of them together makes sense.
Yes. Arthur already has suspicions in the early 50s of what's going on in his agency. He knows that the agency is getting out of control. So he uses Frank occasionally because Frank is very smart and canny. He uses Frank occasionally to do this or that. And then he rewards Frank by introducing him to influential people in New York. And Frank gains financially from that. But Arthur and Frank are quite good friends. But each one thinks that the other has something that that he doesn't have.
So in terms of constructing 100 years of a family life, on some level, creating the characters, putting them in the world, and then finding a way for the world to connect with them so they point in a particular direction.
Yes, so they have to be adventurous. We couldn't have all the characters want to stay on the farm. So Frank, when he's little, his dad feels that he's obstreperous, disrespectful, and in some ways endangering himself as a child. And he occasionally beats him to try and beat it out of him. Well, that never works. But Frank is the one who's going to get out of town. And because he is a sniper in the war, which means he's very observant, he's the one who's got his eye open. He's the one who can see from a distance.
And that develops outward and you're able to do that.
Yeah.
Do you try to keep your own politics out of the book because you're letting the characters do things? How does that work for you?
Well, it's impossible to keep your own politics out of a novel because since a novel is about how characters relate to the larger world, they have to relate either by winning or losing. If they're overcome or if they're the ones who win, there's a political struggle going on. The other thing that happens is that because a novel or a trilogy is so long, you have to talk about the cause and effect. So you have to have a theory about how the world works. And that amounts to politics. But I give my characters varying politics. I don't give them all my politics.
Well, you need conflict, too.
Yeah, you need conflict. And also, a novelist has to be empathetic. So if I give a character maybe different politics from mine, I have to be able to talk about or portray why the character would take up those beliefs. But I would say that all the characters, in some ways, even including the ones who do bad things, by their own lights, they're well-intended, or at least what they're doing is harmless, even though they don't have the understanding that it does create harm.
It seems to me that there are certain characters who became your favorites.
You name them, and I'll tell you if you're right.
Andy?
Yes, I love her.
Claire?
I like Claire.
Janet, toward the end?
Janet and I share a lot of opinions and also a lot of predilections. So that's like saying you like yourself. So that's why her name is Janet, not Jane.
Henry.
I like Henry. Henry realizes, you know, halfway through the book that he's a stuffed shirt. And he has some characteristics that are mine. You know, he's a scholar and he loves certain types of medieval literature and he loves writing very abstruse books about medieval life. But he's the one with the larger perspective. He's the one who's able to say, okay, this is like what happened at the end of the Roman Empire or something like that. So I'm quite fond of Henry.
And the other character I would say, I don't know if like or dislike, but casts a shadow over all of Golden Age is Frank.
Yes. If Frank were in my family, I'd stay out of his way.
On the other hand, as a character to write, he's probably the most fun, I would think.
He was lots of fun. And the question was he going to learn anything? I mean, the problem with Frank from the earliest years is that he doesn't seem to have much of an inner life. So the question that I had to deal with at the end of Early Warning was, can Frank learn anything? Can Frank change? And so that's one of the questions I had to address in Golden Age.
Killing people is something that you have to do over the course of a century.
You do, yeah.
You're going to basically kill off at some point virtually everybody who starts out in the book because 100 years, unless you want somebody to live so long.
Yeah.
In some cases, it's obvious that their deaths fall within the context of the world at large.
Yes.
But some of them do not. How did that process happen that certain characters died at a particular time of various illnesses, let's say?
Well, first of all, I had this problem before when I wrote the Green Letters, because I was writing about the end of this mini civilization on Greenland. And so I'd been there before where I was typing like mad and saying, die, die, die. In this case, I knew that because they're in a book and not in real life, some of them, at least, had to die in relatively dramatic ways. Not everybody could have a heart attack. And so I had to come up with ways that would keep the reader's attention and not be predictable, but would be plausible.
The time frame when they die, it means that, of course, their part of the story ends and they
yes.
can no longer affect other characters. So
well, no, that's not true. One of the things that happens with Frank is, and Arthur, too. Even after he dies, we have to explore the ramifications of the way they raise their children, of the way they went about their life in the world. And that's part of what Golden Age is all about, is the ramifications. What the ones who are still living, what they gained or lost from being the children of these people.
I'm Jane Smiley. After writing this book and looking at the nature of the fact that this is a different kind of book for you, what do you walk away from this, having taken a family through a century? Does it change your perception of, does the research even change your perception of the world? I mean, what do you walk away with?
My perceptions changed. When I did the finished draft of the third book, I was extremely sad and depressed. I think for the characters, but also for the world that they lived in. As I did further drafts, I got inured to what happened to them. Once I knew what happened to them, I got inured to it. By the time I did the last bits on volume 3, you know, they and I, we were all finished with one another.
How often did you have to refer back to the family tree? Or did
Never.
You know them so well?
I knew them well. Yeah, I didn't have to refer back.
Was there any character that you would have liked to have seen more of, but you knew you were kind of limited in your...
Yes, Jesse's sister, Annie, the one who moved off to Milwaukee.
Why?
Because I think she has a story to tell, too. But she didn't stay on the farm, and she had a good dad. She's not closely related to Frank. And so I just couldn't follow her. That fork, that branch would have taken me too far out of the book.
The branch that I would have kind of liked to see, because she was easily the most vile character in the book, was Loretta.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't find her a vile character.
Really?
No. I found this. We're talking about Michael's wife, Loretta.
Right.
But Loretta knows from day one in her relationship with Michael that he does not feel desire for her, that he does not love her. Richie knows that Michael has mistresses. He doesn't know if Loretta knows this. I feel bad for her, that in spite of all her money, in spite of her huge amount of property that she's left by her family, in spite of her sort of interesting family background, because she's from Central California where the family has a 100,000-acre ranch, she doesn't get what she wants. There's a lot of gossip about Loretta in the family where they try to decide how to think about her. But I don't feel negative
that.
Toward her, no.
In an interview about Some Luck, talking about politics, you made the comment, the dilemma for liberals is how to find the inherent meanness required to take on the right. You still feel that way?
I don't know how I feel, because I think the difference between conservatives and liberals is that conservatives, deep down, the thing they most want is power. And I think liberals, deep down, the thing they most want is to discover what things mean, which means that if your opponents want power, they're more likely to push you aside or even do you in. But if indeed they're not interested in meaning, then eventually they're out the window because they come to the point where they don't know what they're doing, which we have to say is maybe the point where the Republicans have come to at this point. I was just in the UK, and I was on a radio show with a conservative historian. And you could see, even though he was very nice to me before and after the show, you could see that all he wanted was to dominate the airwaves at that moment, you know, when people were paying attention to him. And he didn't care. It didn't matter how nice to me he had been before. Once we were on the airwaves, he was going to talk me down. He was going to mansplain to me, blah, blah, blah. And that was an insight for me into the conservative mind. So I think we have to understand that. But are we going to give up who we are, looking for meaning, looking for the right thing to do, in order to do absolutely everything to gain power? I think that's the dilemma that we have.
Well, it also says since art is about finding meaning, it makes sense based upon that analysis that liberals would be more interested in art than conservatives.
Yes, if by art you mean all forms of art, not only painting but also literature, poetry, et cetera, et cetera, and written history. And they do seem to be. Allegedly, the more educated you are, the more likely you are to be a liberal. That's what they say. That's my experience, too.
Jane Smiley, now you've completed this trilogy. Have you started work on something else?
Yes, but I never talk about what's next.
Another novel?
Yes.
You've been listening to an interview with Jane Smiley, whose latest work is a trilogy, three books, The Last 100 Years trilogy. The books are Sumlock, Early Warning, and Golden Age. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.